Hi, and welcome to Lili Logic. I am Lili. I'm Lisa Smith Henderson. My nickname as a child was Lili. My grandmother nickname is Lili. And that's who I am without the Christy Tanner persona, the mask of radio. So it's so good to be here today. And I'm so excited. I love millennials. And I've got one of my favorites here. Max is with me today. And Max, you're kind of a revolutionary, really. Like, I want to say, sort of an accidental activist.
You
So,
know, I think
tell me about your journey in the political realm.
I look at it as disgruntled with a purpose, and what has been the biggest motivating factor for me is that the absolute concentration of wealth is, I mean, it's destroying so much. And, you know, for the fact that in 2024, we had 17 or 18% rise in homelessness in the US, as far as they were able to measure, which any number that is measured when it comes to a homeless census is going to be low by default of the just general community. You were talking about transient people and just kind of access. So maybe it's fair to say we had a 20% rise in homelessness, and the top 10 wealthiest people in the United States accumulated $1 trillion of wealth.
Damn.
And there's something so incredibly wrong with that. Is like, this isn't indicative of a broken system. This is indicative of a system that is working exceptionally well for a group of people. And the element of sort of late stage capitalism that they're working with, or that we're working with and experiencing, the more wealth that is accumulated for a certain group of people, a byproduct of that is human suffering.
What drew this to your attention? I mean, have you always been real socially aware?
Yes, I think so.
See, I want to say, I've known Max, and I remember in third grade him saying, oh, I wish the elections would be over. So you were politically active even in third grade.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it never made me particularly popular. It never really helped my my mental health. But I think it helped instill a level of empathy and curiosity too, to kind of see things beyond the pale. And I can understand that, like, the world and life is difficult for a vast majority of people. And that doesn't happen just because. That nothing is happening just because. There is some sort of engineering that comes about that is much easier to explain through real life circumstances than through some level of conspiracy. And the interest has been, what are those real life circumstances? Who drives it? What does it mean? What does it support? And what does it look like as it grows?
Okay, so we're talking abstract theory. Let's get down to real life. Elon Musk, rich as all get rich as shit. Let's just say it.
Yeah,
running
I mean,
the country.
He's the world's most divorced man, the loneliest, oldest 14-year-old boy. He's got truly all the money that someone can have, and he still fucking sucks. He still wants more. What is clear is, like, of course, money doesn't buy happiness, but money makes life easier in a lot of ways. And you've got a man who's got all the money a person could have. And some people look at it as this altruistic thing of, like, oh, he's doing it for us. No, the fuck he's not. He's doing it because he's vacant. He's a vacant person who just wants his parents to be proud of him at his big age of 50, whatever the fuck. And he wants the approval of hordes of young men, and to be the desire of hordes of young women, and to populate the earth. And it's like, I think about if I had a millionth, just a millionth of the amount of money that he's got, I'd feel a lot better on a day-to-day basis.
So if you had some of Elon Musk's wealth, you wouldn't feel vacant and trying to get the admiration of all.
Well, it's like I've got a fraction of a penny of his wealth effectively, and I don't feel vacant, and I don't care for the desire of young men and women everywhere. I don't want to be a role model to them. I'd prefer not to associate with them truly, because it's like, what the fuck does it, does a teenager have that I want? And so
Okay, so we're looking at this sort of a psychological forensics. This reminds me of when George Bush W went to war to kind of finish the war his father started. And so our country in the world paid a price. Now, okay, this is just my opinion, obviously, for his therapy work around his father. So, are you saying the world is now paying for Elon Musk's psychological therapy structure?
to me, there's nothing therapeutic about it because there's no healing. It's just an intensification. It is like like serial killers escalate. They start as a kid with putting a rabbit in the blender or what have you, and then the fantasy grows larger and it becomes kind of more and more insatiable. And that's what I see with somebody like Elon Musk or Donald Trump, or I mean JD Vance as well. Like, I think these are a series of people that were propped up and admonished at the same time by their kind of structures around them. And it feels like they're on a war path and making it our fucking problem that they're so fucked up,
Okay,
basically.
well, that's a good point. It's not therapeutic if it's not intended to heal. So we're basically, in a way, I don't like the word victim, but in a way, we're victims of their psychological shortcomings.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's when you've got Bezos buying a yacht that's so big that they're having to dismantle a historic bridge so he can get it through a certain waterway. And you've got his employees peeing in water bottles on the job because they can't take bathroom breaks. That is someone who is deeply troubled and doesn't care about people. I saw this thing that was like, if in nature scientists saw one monkey hoarding hundreds of thousands of bananas, more bananas than they would ever need, more bananas they could ever use, because it will go bad before they could even get there, while other monkeys were doing their best just to get one or two, they look at the monkey with 100,000 bananas and think, what the fuck is wrong with that monkey? There is something seriously deranged with that monkey. And, as we're looking at the world's wealthiest people, there's something seriously deranged with them to have that level of capitalist hedonism.
Well, and what I also want to say too, I think we have a notion that sociopaths and psychopaths are serial killers, and more often than not, they are CEOs, they are politicians, they're clergy people, they're great salesmen. So, no offense.
No, it's fair. As a council clergy salesperson, I just stole them out. I don't indulge myself.
Yeah, whichever one you fit. But I think that is, and one thing too, in my study of sociopathy that I've come to understand is we are not brought up to recognize sociopathic or psychopathic behavior or even narcissism because we were brought up with everybody's good at heart. And I think it causes us to not take honest stock of there are people in this world that really don't give a shit.
Yeah, I think that we're seeing the encapsulation of that more and more. And I think it's always existed in one form or fashion. I think in the past, it existed as basically monarchies. It existed as the Crusades. It's always existed in some form or fashion. There's been some level of bloodthirst that the human population has had since recorded history. But there, I think there's been this sort of miscalculation and misalignment of this old idea of bloodthirstiness doesn't evolve, and it does. And what we experience now is the evolution of it, where you've got the Walton family. It's one of the richest families in the world. And Walmart is one of the largest employers with the most amount of employees on, some sort of government aid, whether it be SNAP benefits, housing vouchers, stuff like that. And it is well documented, understood that the link between poverty and crime is very real, and crime often leads to blood. And so it's like we've just added some extra layers in there to have these people around.
So, Max, in kind of preparing me for this interview, you sent a lot of things on the French Revolution and things about the Gilded Age and the Industrial Revolution. So, I want to hearken back to that because, I mean, there were robber barons. This isn't a new thing, but as you say, it has evolved because of the level of wealth and also, I think, the level of globalization. But what do you think we could borrow from the French Revolution to change what's happening in our country today?
Class solidarity and just overall unity for sure. All of us are much more likely to become homeless and to become billionaires. All of us are much more likely to become homeless than become the 1%. Like, forget even a billionaire class, it's just the 1% in general.
Which put, I think, is what, 100,000 a year or
No,
150?
I think it's something that's like a 2 or 4 million in assets overall.
They used to determine it by what you made, but my statistics are probably coming from the 90s. So, okay.
Well, with inflation, it's close.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, just an overall understanding of when people can put political differences aside and get on the same page about, wait, this group of people's fucking us. This group of people are like, it is not immigrants. It's not trans people. It's not anything that the right wing tells us is the problem. We are all victims under the same sort of, we're getting stepped on by the same exact boot.
Well, we're all going to the grocery store and paying the same prices.
Yeah, and having a difficult experience. Most people getting some level of anxious as they get told the total and they put their card in or pay with cash. And even if they understand, like, yeah, I can afford this. What is the impact on my bills for the rest of the month or the rest of this week? Will I be okay if I walk out to the parking lot and my car doesn't start because the battery's dead? Will I be able to afford that battery?
Yep. And I think
And
we're talking like, I remember talking to people years ago saying, well, you mean everybody can afford health insurance? I'm like, no, they can't. I mean, and this was before Obamacare, which still is quite expensive in my mind. And I mean, for example, today I'm retired essentially, so I'm on a fixed income. I did my Instacart because I don't have time to run out to the grocery store today. I did one basket in Publix and one in Kroger. And the one in Kroger was $10 cheaper. I went with Kroger. Now, not everybody's got the time to sit there and do that, like double grocery shop, but that's how real this is.
well, and when the experiences that people choose when they go and buy things can be dictated by their income. So I've got a Walmart and Target right by me. They're Target's 5 minutes away, Walmart's 7 minutes away. They sell effectively the same things. Walmart's home brand is going to be cheaper than anything that's Target's home brand. I'll go to Target because I don't have the emotional or mental capacity to deal with the crowds of Walmart, to deal with the lines, and to deal with even the size and what feels so chaotic about the store. So I'll go to Target to bypass that, knowing I'm going to pay more money. But as I'm going to pay more money to retain or restore a level of mental health effectively, when I think we can kind of come together as a group and say our biggest class difference is what is our financial bandwidth to protect our mental health, as we are all concerned about the amount that we're spending at any given place.
Well, and I think it's also not just about money. It's also about seeing people, like you said, suffering. And all right, so we know what the problems are. The problems are deep, the problems are wide. There are solutions, and the class solidarity is one thing. What do you think about voting with your wallet? Like, let's say everybody boycotted Walmart for a week.
I think it's incredibly effective. I mean, if you look at, there's been a couple of very pivotal things that have happened in the last few years. One of them obviously being COVID, but one of the things that COVID taught us is the power of withholding your dollars and the way that certain companies were losing their minds. And it's, we're told as people, it's a smart thing to have 3 months worth of living expenses saved up. So what the fuck happened when you've got a corporation that has a month of down sales that's saying they're going to go bankrupt? What do you mean? What is this expectation that we as the population are supposed to be able to have this, but a corporation doesn't? And I mean, it goes to show that withholding our funds makes a difference. There's a boycott of Target right now because they scaled back their DEI initiatives, which I think for a lot of companies was a level of a corporate ruse in certain ways, but something that they did to me that was, I mean, it was beyond unnecessary, but just cruel, was they made it clear they were no longer going to seek out minority-owned businesses or designers to do collaboration with. No one asked for that. That was never a part of the equation. That was never, as you could look at it as being like, oh, it was a part of a diversity, equity and inclusion initiative. No, the fuck it's not. It's a part of being a compassionate business run
And
by people.
also being willing to open up to new ideas.
Exactly. Well, and exactly. And getting to a point where you so blatantly dispose those that you give a chance to and treat them like it's less than charity work. Like it's they're just and oh, this was all for show. This is you guys were you didn't bring value to us. Very wrong overall. And so like Target stock has gone down, as I know a lot of young people are making a point to not shop at Target.
Even
You
though you
know,
just gave him a great pitch a few minutes ago.
exactly, exactly. And that's what's really difficult about it is and it's like, as much as I would encourage everybody not shop at Walmart, the reality of it is a lot of smaller towns and communities, Walmart is their grocery store. It's their everything store. They don't have an option. That is, I think part of that's by design, that you don't have an option. You have to support these businesses or else you will starve.
What happened to antitrust laws and monopolies? I thought we weren't supposed to be doing that in this country, and we've just gotten more and more monopolistic, if that's a word.
It has been kind of a slow burn that I think it's as the burn has been slow, we're realizing the whole structure's on fire and it's been on fire for a while until someone tried to put it out, which is Lina Khanna, the FTC, who was phenomenal. But a lot of it started happening around the time of Teddy Roosevelt going and breaking up these monopolies because, I mean, you had all these companies merged together that were effectively called trusts. And that's where, antitrust laws came into the scope of things. Because of the Gilded Age, especially. What is kind of been what I think one of the brightest times in America that has been rolled back consistently was the New Deal. And, with the New Deal, there was a lot of introduction of various government subsidies. Whether it came down to, and something a lot of people don't know about is the government provided free childcare in the 40s so the women could go work in factories and help support war efforts. When we harken back to the 50s and look at, like, oh, stay-at-home moms and shit. The reason they became stay-at-home moms is because after FDR died, there was this hard rail against communism in the 50s with McCarthyism and saying, no, the government shouldn't be doing this. The government shouldn't be taking care and looking out for its people. We need to roll all the shit back from the New Deal,
Well, and
which.
let's just, I do want to insert this piece. It served the government to provide childcare because they needed women to work in the factories. It wasn't an altruistic, like, oh, let's get those women out to work. Bless their hearts. They're bored at home. It was, we need their labor. Okay, so we've spent a fair amount of time. And did I cut you off about the New Deal? I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, I guess the only thing was that the antitrust laws started to get less and less important. And that really started hitting its stride in the 80s with Reagan, which it's like any batshit today, it's safe to say had some sort of root in the Reagan era. That's where it started coming together, and it just really hasn't stopped until Lina Khan came in and started making a lot of moves and obstructing certain things. For example, the Kroger and Albertson merger, which I think Albertson and Kroger, if they had merged, they would have been responsible for 50% of all grocery stores in the US. And the FTC stopped it, the DOJ stopped it. And what they found during their discovery was that there were internal emails sent from executives at Kroger talking about price gouging because they were able to get away with. Prices were high when there were supply chain issues because of COVID. Prices continue to be high because it made the companies money. And I, can't say with absolute certainty, but I don't think it's a coincidence that if you go to Kroger now, there's a lot of yellow tags on everything saying low, new low price because these companies don't want to be looked at as like, oh yeah, we were gouging people and taking advantage of tragedy for long periods of time. So we had our shot with the reemergence of antitrust laws and FTC. It's done.
It is. So, and I was around, I was in broadcasting in the 80s with Reagan and watched mom and pop radio stations that I started at being bought up to the point where there was no mom and pop. That was gone. There were, three, four companies that owned all of the communications in the country and still do. But in the solution, so let's talk about we can vote with our wallet. We can vote at the booth, at the voting booth. Talk about some of the things that you're doing to be proactive to kind of get your message out. As I said, Max, you're an accidental activist in a way. You have got some purpose behind it now. Would you tell us a little bit about what you're doing and why?
I mean, a part of it, a good part of it is talking to people about it and trying to educate them in a very sort of human fashion and, make it relate to our world and our lives. And the reality of it is that we're so busy and worried about different things at all different points in time that it is really difficult to kind of see beyond our own little world. And I think it's a matter of self-preservation to kind of keep all that contained. What is really dangerous about that is when we look at a political sphere, then initiatives that hurt a lot of people, people aren't discussing that. They're just feeling that. And then they're pointing in a direction of who to blame. So I think what's been really important is talking to people about the real life impact of this stuff. What does this mean?
Will you talk a little bit? You have a special needs child, and that has definitely, I know, mobilized you in a way, and it's allowed you to speak from a platform of, I'm a parent, here's what the Department of Education being dismantled would cause. Can you talk about that just for a little bit?
So the having a special needs child, the Department of Education is directly responsible in ensuring that my child has an equitable education, that he is given the amount of resources needed to have the level of education that other children his age would receive that, are neurotypical. The Department of Education also provides massive amounts of funding, $15.5 billion worth of funding that they give to states that are very clear about, hey, this goes specifically to special needs students. And, under these guidelines and understandings. So when I talk to people about it, I voice from the amount of concern that if my son doesn't have an adequate level of care now at this point in his life at 6 years old, he may never be independent. And I will never forgive a government or people that made a decision to ensure that he's never independent. And, and I talk about that's like, parents worry when their kids go to school because of things like bullying and school shootings, or even just is there a stomach bug going around? And is my kid going to come home with the flu? And to add an additional layer on there of, oh, will my son's education get stripped away? That's a big grave thing that most people don't consider. But when you start to consider like, oh shit, that's a real life possibility. It doesn't feel good. And, for those that revel in it, I mean, it's just like those aren't people worth reasoning with or talking to anyways. But vast majority of the population isn't for stripping the rights away from children. They're not
Right.
for.
Whether they're neurotypical or neurodivergent or
Yeah.
physically handicapped, regardless, I don't think we want to see anybody get deprived of something that the mainstream receives. So, what kind
Well,
of things are you doing to advocate basically for him?
talking to people in real life, talking to people online in forums that might not be necessarily political either, where if it's like on Reddit, for example, making posts out there of like, hey, as like we've looked at moving to a different state that's got a better education system and better funding on a state level than where we are currently, making a post about it that's like, hey, this is something that we're having to consider because of this. And if that subreddit is just responsible for a city, is what it's about. It's not about politics. It's not about the Department of Education. But someone is coming out and saying, hey, we're really concerned about this where we are. We think this place could be a safe haven for us. That gets the conversation going, where people might not be aware of, like, oh shit, they're trying to take rights and things away from children. That's not okay. They say it's to save money, but it just seems like it's hurting kids. That starts to change the tune. And I think inspiring people and helping guide people towards different resources to learn and understand more. And the problem is a lot of people voted without doing any legwork.
Right.
Majority of people, if they're tasked with getting a new car, they're going to do more research into that car or just the process of buying one than they would about, political stances. Talking to people about that's so flawed. That logic is dangerous. It's hard and it's irresponsible. And just being clear with people that it is irresponsible when you don't invest the time to learn these kinds of things, because a child like mine may have his future stripped away.
So you're dipping into pockets of online, social media, just expressing your concerns, kind of where you're at as a parent. Not necessarily going to a right-wing thing and going, "Hey man, you're wrong." So
Yeah.
you're doing it in and of your own life. What role does journalism play? And can we take
It
advantage
plays.
of local newspapers, local TV, local magazines?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, because it's the changing things on a national level starts from a local level everywhere you go. And a big element of proof of that is where, every state has their senators, every state has their congresspeople. We elect those congresspeople, and sometimes those congresspeople make decisions for the whole country that sway things permanently. An example is Bill Cassidy, senator from Louisiana, who is a, he's a medical doctor. He went to the RFK hearings with a lot of very major doubt about things, and he ended up moving forward with the approval. And now, granted, I don't ever expect Louisiana to be a bastion of blue voters by any stretch of the imagination. But it goes to show that's like, hey, this one guy may be responsible for a really consequential decision for not just the country, but the world, depending on how things end up coming together. So yeah, on a local level, it is so important, because at the end of the day, there's always more of us than there are of them. And that's what the elite and ruling class hate. And whatever it takes to help people forget that is fantastic. That's the biggest function. Washington Post, for example, they blocked a cartoon going out from a very tenured cartoonist there that had Jeff Bezos at the feet of Donald Trump. And Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. That ended up being pushed out. Jeff Bezos was the one who blocked an endorsement of Kamala, him specifically. And now, granted, that's on a larger level, but all these things start on a very local end. It starts with who are we electing to our school boards? Do their kids even go here? Somewhere where
Yeah.
I live, there's a woman she has her kids in private school and got elected to the local school board. So it's like, why didn't we rally even harder against that person? I only found out about that because people spoke out publicly, because there were signs, there were things in local publications, things on Facebook that I got to see that were real. Most of all, they were real, but it helped raise awareness about, like, oh, this lady kind of sucks. Like, I think she's got our kids' best interests because she won't even send our kids around here.
Well, and I think that's one thing that coming last year, as I was doing some of my research, was how pointed Republicans were in getting officials elected on local levels. And I mean, you can see the changes that it affected. So if we want to move forward on behalf of our children and the middle class, first thing to do is what?
Address the real problem. But what I think is important is looking at the Republican playbook starting in 2008, especially, can teach everybody who wants change a lot, which has to do with very simple messaging and unification and putting differences to the side at the end of the day. The election in 2016 of Donald Trump is a great, showcasing of that. If you had Donald Trump insult Ted Cruz and Ted Cruz's wife and Ted Cruz's family saying that Ted Cruz's dad had a part of the JFK assassination, Ted Cruz talking about how much, Donald Trump sucked. And then Ted Cruz endorsed him later. You had almost an entire party move that way. They coalesced together. And something that has plagued the left forever and still does from the most kind of just staunch, purely liberal people to far left, approaching the area of communism, is that the bickering, they can't put differences aside. They can't coalesce around a single issue. We have to coalesce around a single issue, is our lives are difficult today and things are unaffordable today, not because of immigrants, not because of trans people, not because of any marginalized community. It is the only minority that makes our life difficult is the 1%.
Max, gosh, this is so helpful, and I appreciate your time today. I want to hear more about what we can do. One of the things that I think was really helpful, Marianne Williamson gave the number to the Capitol switchboard, so you don't have to individually call your senators. You can just call this one number, ask for your senator, ask for your representative, and that number is 202-224 3121. Once again, Capitol switchboard number, call, ask to speak to your congressman, tell him it's a constituent call, 202-224-3121. Thanks for being my guest today on Lili Logic, Max. And your last word would be what?
We just have to remain hopeful, hopeful and in motion.
Ah, great note to end on. Lili Logic comes to you every week, and thank you for listening. LiliLogic.com is the website, and please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. We'll be back in our next episode to talk to Max to get more ideas from him on how we can have a radical revolution and also to get rid of the malignant minority.